Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see, maybe online if they'll make sure they're muted. I don't know where that's coming from necessarily. But good morning. The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. The time is 10:02 in the a.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Begich and Senator Hughes, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. Senator Steve and Senator Machicki will be excused today, but we do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Mary Gwen, our recording secretary, and Emma, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. The first item up on today's agenda is Senate Bill 34 relating to tribal compact schools. We'll bring Senate Bill 34 back before the committee. This is our sixth hearing on Senate Bill 34. To begin today's discussion, I'd like to share an observation I made during a recent meeting with the staff at the Bureau of Indian Education. Based on that conversation, my understanding is that in the lower 48, tribes have schools on sovereign land that are outside the public education system. In other words, they have autonomy but lack funding. The situation is a little different here in Alaska. Our rural schools have funding but lack autonomy. So for Alaska, tribal compacting appears to be more about self-determination than it is about increased funding. We have representatives from the Bureau of Indian Education on the phone. If members have any questions, we have Sharon Pinto, Deputy Bureau Director of School Operations, Bureau of Indian Education, and Margot DeLon, Associate Deputy Director, Division of Performance and Accountability. Are there any questions?
Well, maybe, yeah. Senator Holland, they're not.
Oh, they're not on board yet? I'm sorry.
Well, when they are on board, Senator Holland, the question I would ask them is that it goes to something that President Kitka mentioned, and that is, you know, one of the keys here is to be able to blend the BIE funding with the state funding. That's one of the things we've talked about. And so the last meeting we brought up the potential of a separate title in the statutes that might be a charter-ish like title. And the question I would have for the BIE people would that in any way hamper the ability to blend funds if there was, you know, this idea of a state-titled statute? You know, is there a limitation for a tribe and what would be effectively a state public entity to be able to commingle funds? And I'm guessing the answer is no, but I think that might be, I mean, that seems to me that might be an obstacle. So it looks like President Kitka put her hand up, so perhaps she has an answer to that.
Hey, a brief at ease. All right, Senate Education Committee's back on the record. Thank you for your indulgence. Sorry for that interruption. We do have Joel Isaac and President Kitka, and if y'all care to come take the presenter's table. All right, and do you have anything to say in response to Senator Begich's question? Please, President Kitka, if you'd put yourself on the record.
Yes, for the record, my name is Julie Kitka. I honor serving as the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And in response through the chair to Senator Begich's question, I think that the issue of funding or involvement with the Bureau of Indian Education is not timely. And it's not timely for two reasons. One, we have sent a letter to the Solicitor of the Interior, Robert Anderson, asking for clarification on Department of Interior being able to use their funding mechanisms for compacting on that. That issue also came out at the Senate Indian Affairs Committee field hearing that was just held that Senator Murkowski chaired up in Anchorage. And we're waiting for that memo, the legal opinion, to come. Then the issue of their involvement or not involvement comes into play. I testified at that hearing, we are not looking at creating Bureau of Indian Affairs schools. We're not looking at going backwards. we're looking at moving forward in a hybrid on that. So I wouldn't want an answer from the Bureau of Indian Education to inadvertently mislead this committee thinking it's going on a different path. When we testified on this compact, we're looking at moving forward, leaving history behind, building something new, using the momentum that we see that our people need to have for real transformational education. We're not looking at creating BIA schools how the way they used to be before. And so that's a mindset that we need to put aside. Bureau of Indian Education, if they were testifying today specifically on that, would point to the prohibition in appropriations against any funding coming to Alaska. We also testified, we requested that prohibition be dropped. It is not fair to Alaska Natives at a time when you have the most massive federal resources coming all around the country in every part of the government for Alaska Natives to be excluded from a stream of funding. It doesn't mean that we want to compete with the other tribes going there, but that prohibition needs to disappear as well. So I just wanted to put that in the record before people then all of a sudden go, well, we don't want you to have BIA schools because we have enough problems funding our own schools. We're not looking at competing with them on that. And also in the federal funding, we're also looking at Department of Education opportunities, and it's not just for Interior. So.
Thank you, President Kutka.
Paula.
Senator Begich.
So to be clear, I have no interest in going back to the failed BIA system. It was ridiculous. It didn't work here, and it destroyed our ability to educate young people. So I think let's be real clear about that. My question is simply, one of the first issues that were brought up the second hearing on this bill, maybe the third, was the idea of being able to compact so you'd have the ability to commingle or participate by taking some of those federal resources, not to restrict the resources you get here, but to find those resources. So I want to be very clear, President Kika, I am not talking about going back to the past. I'm talking about ensuring that if we start walking down a path today, that we don't walk down a path that we then have to stop, turn around, come all the way back, and start over again. That's why I respect the not asking a question before we know the answer for it. Yeah. That is one of our – I see your lawyer in the back smiling a little bit when I say that, but never ask a question you don't know the answer to if it might lead to the wrong answer. In this case, didn't know the answer, was just curious if that question had been asked. I respect waiting for that answer, but – understand, I don't want us to waste our time going down the path that we have to turn around and then just start over again. That would just slow us down another year. Compacting is the answer. Finding the path to it is the key.
And Mr. Chairman, may I respond? And just to give you an idea, is our idea of this hybrid and looking at other federal resources is much broader than that. We're looking at whether or not there's additional resources that can come from the National Institutes of Health, all these research. We're looking at a whole of government approach on what areas that can be coming. But what we're looking for Interior is utilizing their compacting mechanism, the vehicle that they have within Interior, not rearranging how they're all funding everything in Interior. So it's a minor distinction on that. Of using the vehicle. We would like to have direct federal authority that says Department of Education can compact with Alaska Native tribes in a demonstration. But until we have that direct federal authorization from them, we're asking Interior to use their authority. And we'd be glad to provide the committee the letter we sent to the solicitor asking for the clarification, just for the record. And final thing on the BIA schools on that, and it's also one thing that we testified on the federal side, is when you think about the time in which the last BIA schools were transferred over to the state, that was at the time in which Prudhoe Bay was kicking out a lot of revenues, the permanent fund was growing really huge, and the state of Alaska was, our congressional delegation was having a hard time protecting resources coming into the state as the state budget was just exploding. It's the same time when the federal government transferred over the railroad from being a federal railroad to a state railroad is the same time they did in these education schools. It was intended to to transfer them over, but because there was just too much wealth in that. What our position is that, yes, there is a lot of wealth in the state, but there's also equities involved on that too. Other parts of the country have an incredible amount of wealth. California is one of the fifth or sixth largest economies in the world. The areas where you have gaming and everything like that, large, incredible wealth on that. And to say, use that rationale of the growing of the permanent fund as a reason to block us out from resources, we think that needs to be rethought and put aside.
All right, Joel Isaac, thank you so much for joining us today in person. I was looking for you electronically, didn't notice you're in the room. You have something to offer on the current topic?
Joel Isaac, the Department of Education Early Development Project Coordinator, Tribal Liaison, through the chair, Senator Begich. I think a way to possibly shine an example on the federal side of funds coming, being able to come through, and the way that setting up state tribal education compact schools as local education agencies aligns with the federal title funds, so that it's the same kind of entity that they currently fund. And so it allows those funds to come in. What for a STEC or a compact school, if they choose to accept that, like say Title I funding, they have to make sure that they're in compliance with all the federal guidelines. A lot of federal education title funding is not mandatory to accept, but if you do accept it, you have to meet the obligations. And so that's the thinking of what do districts right now title-wise receive. The language is set up in a way that allows them to receive it, because it's in compliance with federal registry language. Another area of funding that would possibly be able to come into the state that currently can't, that STECs would allow for, is certain federal registry guidelines for competitive grants on a national level are only eligible if you are a local education agency serving tribal youth. So we don't currently receive those in the same way that other public schools, not just BIA schools in the lower 48, but other public schools in the lower 48 are eligible, because the tribe is not in control of the school. The federal registry guidelines also allow for grants specifically for tribes to build capacity to become a tribal education agency, which right now in Alaska, they are not considered a local education agency. And so those kind of federal registry guidelines allow funds to come specifically to tribes who don't have that district kind of status. Once you become a local education agency, you no longer are eligible for that pot of competitive funding. And so the federal registry guidelines for Department of Education, Department of Indian Education, BIA, all use different definitions. And that's an example maybe of how asking that question, how would this play out if we use this terminology? It does make certain kinds of funding ineligible, because those federal funds are earmarked specifically for tribes that don't have a local education agency status to help them. Once they have that status, then there's a different pot of money that's designed to help that. So this is kind of, there's building funds, and then they're to get to a certain level. And then once you're at that level, then there's a different kind of fund that helps fund operations or building or equipment. I'll stop there, but that's just, I think, maybe some of the practical sides of the federal registry language that I deal with on a regular basis for Brian Work at Deed. I appreciate the question.
Just a quick question. When you say building, is it actually brick and mortar building, or are we talking about program building?
There are some grants that allow for non-permanent building construction. So if you have an existing facility, you can remodel it. So that's the part of, like, there's a distinction between the two. So if a tribe has facilities that it has in hand, but maybe they're not the best educational facilities, they might be eligible, and I know some who are, that currently get funding where they could remodel a building to make it educational space. So that's that part of, like, which part is considered hard infrastructure. There's the brick and mortar exterior, but there's also brick and mortar interior, and then there's technology, IT, curriculum that are all objects, but they have different funding streams that can come in.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It implies to me that the definition section of whatever bill we finally come up with is going to have to be very clear, because you may have a situation where a blank, you know, whatever we decide we call a compact school in Alaska, may be considered a, you know, the name, the three different types that you've named of, you know, local education. You had three of them, a tribal designated, I can't remember what the third one was, but the, it's going to have to be an all-inclusive definition to be, so I'm just thinking sort of down the road here that the bill will have some complexities related to ensuring the definitions are clear for the very purposes you just described.
So, Mr. Isaac, you're with the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School program, no?
Department of Education.
Oh, sorry, I got the wrong thing up here. Can you, my question was, can you provide some insight with on charter schools and how they differ from regular school in the system?
Yes. So I think through the chair, Holland, I think that's a very helpful question for some clarity for Mrs. Joel Isaac, Department of Education, tribal liaison. So if we look back to what chartering is, there's two pieces to the term chartering. It's a funding mechanism, which is a contract. And there's also, charter is often used to describe like the direction that a school might go. So we think like, what's your charter? Where are you going? But it's also a funding mechanism. So the history of education contracting in Alaska is very dark. It started about 140 years ago with the federal government coming in and doing education contracts through Indian education agents. And the what happened, and this kind of, this is why the term contracting is very, it's a difficult word to hear in education for tribal people. So our children had a certain dollar amount that they were, it would equate to. And the Indian education agents would come and hunt them and capture them, throwing them in backs of airplanes, handcuffing them, ripping them out of parents' arms, and bring them into the schools. Once they were at the school, they received the federal funds. This was found to be unconstitutional the way that it was done after the first 5 years, and that was stopped in that specific way, but the precedent had already been set. And that's where when we have the conversations about boarding schools and the torture of children for money from the federal government by those education agents is what tribes, when we hear the word, I'm using me as a Native person in this instance, I'm not a tribe, when we hear the word contract, it's children being tortured. The disenrollment process for those contracted schools was you either had to be hidden away when you if you got sent home. I work with elders who their grandparents took them into the woods and kept them from getting to school because they wanted to protect their children. There are communities that would raise money for gas and go to the school. And they asked the students, which one of your classmates needs to leave the most? So if you can imagine asking 10-year-olds in a concentration camp, who should leave? And those 10-year-olds, like, this person's closest to dying, you should take them home. There's examples like that. There's examples where, in some areas where the children weren't removed, the parents had to move into town to be closer to their kids, and the Indian education agents would come by the houses and look in windows and make sure they weren't speaking Native language to their kids, that they weren't singing, that they weren't drumming. And so if parents wanted to speak to their youth, their kids in our Native languages, they'd have to close the curtains and whisper, because that's how invasive this permeated all of our lives. Children were picked up, they were tricked, like, would you like to go visit your brother? And it's like, yeah, I haven't seen him in 5 years. And then they take him to the boat, throw him in, take them upriver to the boarding school. So that was the way, if you were kept hidden away, you got to disenroll from school. The other way was to try and escape. And the way that it's documented in the archives is enrollment reduction, a death by exposure. That's how the students were exiting school, was they would try and escape. And if you can imagine being an 8-year-old running away in the wilderness of Alaska in winter, you're not going to make it. That's what contracting was based on in the federal way that it was executed.
Yeah, when you first mentioned dollars associated with children, it popped in my head BSA, but you're talking about a bounty.
It's a bounty. That's why the word contracting is such a dangerous word for tribes to, like, we've been through contracting. It was not a good thing. And I think that you, as it has been recognized, I'm not having to convince you that torturing children to death is a bad thing. No one's challenging that. So that's where contracting started. In 1990, if we jump forward in history, post-boarding schools, post-BIA boarding schools, in 1995, the Alaska state statutes were updated to include charter school law. And what the way that charter schools today function in Alaska is that there's a dual application process. So a community, a group of people get together and form a charter outlining the type of school they're wanting to make. They get the freedom, some freedoms in hiring, and then they get some freedoms, much more freedom and latitude in curriculum choice. It has to be approved by a local school district. If the local school district approves it, then it comes to the State Board of Education after it's been reviewed by the Department of Education. So the Department of Education reviews it. If everything's found to be in order, it moves on to the docket for the State Board of Education to consider, which they just did a series of those yesterday. And then if that's approved by them, then the school can move forward. And so it's still charter school law places whatever the charter school is in a contract relationship under a school district. And so that's a little bit about how contracting works.
So a quick question. Because you kind of precluded the discussion of a charter school with the discussion of contracting and negative stigma. So apparently early on there was a negative stigma about charter schools because of the word contracting associated with them?
To Chair Holland, Joel Isaac, Department of Education. That's in the discussions with Alaska's education challenge that the committee has heard about before. That's part of the discussion about why is chartering not the mechanism? If it's been around since 1995, why hasn't it seen the languages come back to life and more tribes doing this? It's had 25 plus years to see if that mechanism might be successful. The piece, I'm not negating charter schools as unsuccessful education entities. I think we see a lot of success from charter schools. What's successful about it is one piece of it, the curriculum piece, when it's either immersion or through the language and through the culture, we see great growth that nothing else has been able to achieve. But the process to get there is restricted. And it creates a middle piece where when tribes go to apply for a charter school, the tribe doesn't actually operate the charter school because it's through the district. And so if you as a cultural entity are wanting to teach through the culture, not just bringing some of it into the classroom, but actually teach through the culture, you're having to translate that concept and the linguistic side to a school board, a local school board, and then the department and the state board. And that is very time consuming, and oftentimes it gets stopped at the local level because it's like that just can't happen. There are some examples of charter schools that have been like Iprun and Bethel and the Alaska Culture Charter School in Anchorage that I think that they found a good working relationship with their school districts to allow things to proceed. But meeting the statewide need, it has not been shown to be successful for the kind of transformation that we're looking at. And it comes down to chartering is a two-part piece. It's a funding mechanism as a contract, and then it's the direction for curriculum that they can go. And if we think about the term compacting is also a funding mechanism, and then it also allows for a provision of service to be done in a specific way. Chartering right now has that curriculum freedom. Compacting would allow for curriculum freedom and some more things still within state law, where without that piece, we can't get to the next level of growth that's needed. It also creates a different kind of relationship to where there's efficiency that's created by not having to go through a three-tiered system to receive funds and back and forth for communication. And so those are some of the differences between what chartering as a term and compacting as a term means, and why, and that's not the only reason why chartering was found not to be the solution, but that's a big part of it. Is if we also look at IHS, the Indian Health Service compacting, it started out as a contract, and Julie's done a very good job explaining the history of that process. And there was transformational change that happened when it went from contracted service to compact service. And the education kind of equivalent is charter schools today aren't harming kids like BIA boarding schools were, not trying to make that connection. But to bring it to the next level of change, compacting is the proven mechanism both for funding and for the delivery, in this case, education services.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Isaac. Senator Hughes?
So one of the things we talked about when we talked about the charter school not having all the background you just gave us was the fact that we could end up with 200 different entities working with the department, and that might be a bit cumbersome as far as bureaucracy. So if we didn't go the charter school route, how could we, is there a way that we could streamline that so it's not like having 200 different school districts as far as the work with DEED?
Do you want to go first?
This is a demonstration project.
Put yourself on the record.
Julie Kitka, Athens. This is a demonstration project. There'll be limited ones. So the idea of 200 all of a sudden doing that, people know when they're ready to take on this additional responsibility and accountability. A demonstration project will be limited in the first year. We're going to be evaluating it. You will be evaluating it. The commissioner will be evaluating. The state board will be evaluating it. If it doesn't prove its value, it won't be continued. And I do think that the idea that it's going to expand all over the state is not accurate for a demonstration project. We're not asking you to change everything overnight and make that available for everybody. We're saying, let's test out this concept. Let's test out, can we get transformational change? Can we improve things for Native children and other children in the area on that? Can we step up to what the challenges that we deal with today, as well as taking a look at the new infusion of broadband money and all these things, and design something, leaving the past behind? We're not trying to recreate anything from the past. We're not building it off of grievances. We're saying, let's explode in innovation and ideas and empower people and take a chance. That's all we're saying. And at the last hearing that we had, the federal one on that, even Senator Murkowski mentioned towards the end of the hearing on the record, she says, I've been having this whole line of question, and I realize all I've been doing is tearing apart your idea, haven't even been asking questions that are, what good can you do of it? And she says, I've come full around instead of tearing this apart. I think this is a great idea. So I do think it really requires us to say, take a chance and say, Can we support the State Board of Education, the commissioner, to have that, have accountability? We're not asking for anything to be not accountable. We're asking to be accountable. But what we want to do is be able to have a government-to-government relationship with the state, be able to negotiate how much of the demonstration project we're capable. Maybe we're only capable in one area of doing one school or one grade or two grades. But give us the opportunity to negotiate with the state to see what can we do with this type of process, and could it prove valuable? Could it be expanded the next year for another 5 or 10 or whatever and stuff? That's all we're asking to do. And as simple as possible, charter schools is not the path for doing it. It's got to be more transformational. It's got to have its own segment. But again, it's only demonstration. We're not asking you to change your mindset on anything else. We're saying, give us a chance to try to prove this out. Give us a chance to see if we can build a hybrid and if we can bring additional federal resources to it that maybe have never come to the state. Give us that chance. That's all we're saying.
Follow up.
And thank you for that. And I do have a very open mind. I want this to work. I do. And I understand it's a demonstration project and would be limited from the outset, but maybe you're being from DEED would understand. I'm thinking more the management side. I don't see it as an impossible hurdle, but it is something that would have to be dealt with at the department. And have you thought about if the demonstration project were successful, which we hope it would be, and as more and more tribes would want to get on board, how that might look for the department and how it might be manageable and not cumbersome.
Through the chair,
Mr. Isaac.
Senator Hughes, through the chair, Joel Isaac, indeed. I think that that's a very important question, and it allows, I do appreciate the question because it allows to show like what the department's been doing to get ready for compacting. The amount of material capital, the amount of resources and people to do the work is one of the limiting factors. So for a tribe, thinking about these are one of the differences between Alaska and Washington, for instance. There's one school in Washington that compacted that wasn't a BIA school to start with. And I've spent more time looking at that model. And what they had to be able to do it was they had the infrastructure and the personnel to be able to start a school. It's a fairly large endeavor to open a school, even if it's a small one. And we know that tribes can do it because there are tribes that are doing it, that are positioning themselves to be ready to do it. And what they're doing is they need the governance structure, thinking like we see school boards as a governance structure. Some have education committees. Some use the tribal council to serve as that school board, and they put it in their bylaws as a way to identify that role. But getting all those pieces together, because this is an opt-in process, I know some tribes that have said, we're not interested in compacting. So I can guarantee there's not going to be 229 outright from the ones that we're not doing that. There's also a certain level of risk for a tribe with it being a short term, right? It's a demonstration project. If they're willing to trust the state and trust the federal government, is this going to continue? So there's that kind of the mentality of we're going to watch and see. We're supportive of this idea. Please pass this. But we're going to wait and see if some, maybe the ones that are gung-ho about it can figure it out. And when they figure it out, then we'll sign on. For the department side, for the capacity, one of the things that's helpful about the way that it's written with there being local education agencies is that we have the mechanisms to communicate with school districts already in place. So thinking about budget accounting, this creates another line item. It doesn't create a whole new position and having to figure out an additional structure and reporting mechanism. It's adding one more line in the software that can already handle that. So that's part of what we've been having the discussions internally about. What does this impact look like? There's some education that we as deed staff have to experience, like, okay, what does this look like to have more? But so far the feedback from staff hasn't been, this is not doable. Also, in looking at, we see this with charter school applications. I think this is an example of looking at some other systems when they came on board, what was successful, what took time, is that not all the applications were approved because it took time to build the solid application. So in that, the commissioner would have the year to develop the application process of negotiations and approval. And so it might take tribes a little bit to do that back and forth to get a successful application put together. And that's one of the powerful things about compacting as well. It's not just a, no, you're not approved, try again next time. It's a, we're communicating back and forth to create success, but if you need more time, you're not going to make this beginning of start of school. Let's work with you throughout the time. So there's the process itself limits the number of tribes that might be able to actually get all the pieces together right away. I have spoken with tribes, at least five, in varying regions of the state, and they're like, can we demonstrate? There's not legislation yet. And I tell them, you can do everything you would need to do to get ready, so then there is, you're ready to go. And there's a handful, 5 to 10, it fluctuates for how much they're knocking on the door, and they return and keep knocking. And those are the ones who have been proactive. They're sending their youth off to college to become teachers. They're getting buildings. They're figuring out certification. They're doing all that legwork, which the compact schools would have to have. And so just the amount of time that it takes to spool up is a limiting factor. And the part of the in the conversations with tribal leadership, they've expressed and seen, I think, the wisdom of it, not putting a limitation. Because what that signals is that this isn't an open process. It's competitive. We're pitting, if there's a limitation in the number, it pits tribes against each other to be competitive and creates a bad situation. But if the process creates successful outcomes, then we want as many that can come through the door as possible. But knowing that there's only so many that will be wanting to come and have all the things together to do that. So that's the kind of the rationale behind it, that the department, we haven't seen this as something that would sink deed. This is within the scope of what we would be able to do, but also in compacting being a relationship that's dynamic, we've been very responsive to that request, and that's why.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Isaac. Senator Begich, do you remember your question?
You just touched on it. You know, I'm troubled, actually, by what you just said, some of what you just said, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But I want to start by saying when we left here at the last meeting, I didn't realize the charter thing was something we didn't want to go down a road. We didn't want to go down because it's not the comments that we made from the table. So, you know, to hear that now, I recognize what you're saying, and I agree with it. The contracting word is a terrible word. I get that, and I understand that. And so I'm more than happy to shift the dialogue to something else. The reason we brought up the issue of dealing with chartering was to try to find a simpler route, not a more complex route. So I feel a little disarmed, if you will, by not knowing that the dialogue had changed between the last meeting and this meeting. So I feel a little, I guess, put out by that. But, you know, that's part of the process. But let me go a step further in saying that when we talk about, when we came to the reasoning of chartering, it's because of other protections that are in our law. There's the question of representation, of whether people have, you know, elected representation, because we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility as the school board and the assembly for this state. You mentioned that the state laws would apply, Joel, but if the state laws are going to apply in this process, we have a responsibility and a role in that. So we need to know the scope of the project. And what you just described was the scope that is in a scope. I absolutely agree with President Kitka that we should be willing to experiment and move forward with the demonstration project. But I am not clear what the scope of this demonstration project is. What I heard was it would be open and that we would begin to do more and more and more depending on how many applications came in. And that takes me to the second point, which is, you mentioned, a proven mechanism for education. So here, we haven't had that proven mechanism for education, but I'm certain you're going to provide us data that shows that it actually does what it is intended to do. So tell me what the scope is, and then let's use that. And I'm addressing this first, if I may, to Joel Isaac, and then President Kitka, please. But tell me what the scope is perceived by the Department of Education for the project so that we know what we're saying yes to. Because we have that fundamental responsibility. And I'm not going to be comfortable abrogating that responsibility without knowing what the clear picture of what we're going for is here. So that, to me, is critical. I want to see outcomes for education where kids learn, whether they're learning in an indigenous language, whether they're within an indigenous culture. I want to be sure that they come out of the process able to live in whichever world they choose to live in. That, to me, is what my responsibility is in this position. So, and perhaps those words are a little aggressive and a little harsh, and I apologize for that, but I'm feeling as though almost a bit set up, and I'm not comfortable with that. So please explain to me answers to at least those two pieces, scope, and then provide me the mechanisms, the proven mechanisms that show that the outcomes actually improve lives, because it takes more than a year to do that.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, Joel Isaac, Deed, tribal liaison. I do appreciate the question, and I think that these are the hard questions that people are wanting to see, and we're compacting as a government-to-government agreement is something that's different than some of the other educational models that are out there right now. And that we've seen that success in Washington. And so thinking about the scope and how students benefit, what kinds of, how do we gauge success, that those kinds of, when I hear that scope and student, that's what I'm hearing. And so there are things like increased graduation rates. There are things like increased class attendance. And if we look at the data in Washington State from their STEC programs, their State Travel Education Compact schools, all of their graduation rates increase. And their attendance rates are increasing. And so that's one of the most important indicators of student learning success is, are they actually at school? And if we, in hearing the feedback from districts that are struggling, it's like the kids aren't in the classroom. And so compacting, and thinking, when I say that proven mechanism, compacting has proven that it increases student attendance. And that's that critical first step. And we think about, and I'm thinking back to yesterday's joint hearing with the state board as well, for what kinds of assessment tools do we use? And the bill, the way, and how this committee would expect to see feedback brought back for success and hearing how it's going, there's two parts to it. There's one that takes the current standards and assessments that are already used by all the other types of schools. And the education compact schools would have to conduct those as well. They're bound to funding requirements. This bill also would include a piece that allows tribes to communicate what success looks like based on the negotiation. And so what I've brought is an example of a Dena'ina educational model. Like, how do tribes define educational success? And this was first done in the language, and there's about 14 of them. It's brief, and it's to prepare school students for the realities of today's world. That's number one, because the reality of the world, it changes. These are first language speakers who were shipped off to California to build Fort Ross and then came back to Alaska, and they saw this massive change. And so it includes learning to read English. It's not excluding that. It includes computer technology.
Mr. Isaac. I'll just say, if there are 14 points and we're going to spend a minute discussing each point, that'll be 15 minutes.
Yeah, no, I'll be much more brief on that. I'm touching on that as the primary one, as the header. Okay. So if that is the piece, through the chair, I appreciate that. They should learn to focus their minds. They should learn how to help us. They should learn all the language and the skills. They should be aware of the old people and retain all their language. They should encourage parents, fathers, mothers, and kids. They should be aware of the land that they're on, that it's Dena'ina land, the Dena'ina area. And they should compare all living things, show how living things grow. And so we see, like, I can't tell you what every tribe's going to define success, but if you can imagine a report based on those kinds of outcomes, it provides the ability for tribes to communicate what success looks like, but also in tandem with what the data you're used to seeing as well, to be able to show that correlation of success. So I hope that helps.
Mr. Chairman, that's quite reassuring. Thank you.
And President Kitka, if you care, I just would like to move on. We do have this slated, SB 34. We'll be back, of course, next week.
I wanted to, address Senator Hughes' concern, and I think that we have a little bit different perspective than the Department of Education on the limitations in the demonstration. We would be comfortable with a limit of 10 tribes or tribal applications in the first year, as long as there was a process of readiness for compacting that was maintained within the Department of Education. We could envision after the first year and the commissioner and his team have gone through that, where they come back to this committee and say, I can't tell you how excited we are, and we have another list of another 10 that are ready for doing it and stuff. So I think to get the demonstration started, to have a number that is geographically spread, because we wouldn't want it just all in urban areas or just all in rural areas, but that would be okay as long as the commissioner has a readiness to compact process going on that can support the committee. So just a little minor difference.
All right. Thank you, President Kitka. And at this point, is there anything else from the committee? This has been the sixth hearing on this topic, and I do appreciate the clarification. I didn't necessarily feel disarmed. I understand maybe conversations y'all had. You were swaying back and forth between charter schools, compact schools, trying to see what fits, what's the best fit for the program. We do have the schedule again for next week, but thank you both for coming in today. At this point, I'm going to set Senate Bill 34 aside. And the next item up on today's agenda is Senate Bill 140 relating to gender in sports. We'll bring Senate Bill 140 before the committee. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 140 in the 32nd legislature. I'll note before we begin, due to the volume of email testimony we received so far, that we are rescheduling public testimony to a later date. There's no subterfuge intended here. We're actually going to probably schedule it for Saturday, two Saturdays from now, to give a lot more time on the weekend. Also, maybe people who are at work and won't have a chance to participate. Senator Hughes, would you care to take the presenter's table?
Thank you.
All right, Senator Hughes, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. As we, I'm not sure if the Senate President is listening online, but I'm Shelley Hughes, Senator for District F, Palmer Chugiak, and I appreciate the consideration of the committee of this piece of legislation that a number of Alaskans have approached me and asked me to carry. We have entitled SB 140, if the legislation were to pass, the Even Playing Field Act. 50 years ago, women's sports changed forever. In 1972, slightly over 300,000 women and girls played college and high school sports in the United States. As of 2022, the number of female athletes in the U.S. has increased by over 900%. To more than 3.5 million women and girls, thanks to the passage of Title IX and the end of discrimination against girls and women in sports. Mr. Chair, when I was a child and a teenager, which I'm dating myself a bit here,
20 years ago,
I loved basketball and I shot hoops in my backyard in the driveway, but there was no option for me to play at school. The only option was to be a cheerleader and root for the boys' team, and that did not interest me. Fortunately, my daughter had options due to Title IX, and she played varsity girls basketball in high school. But this year, as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Title IX, women and girls stand once more at risk of being discriminated against, of losing an even playing field in sports. An ever-increasing trend of male-bodied athletes in women's sports threatens competition and fairness. Girls and women should not be robbed of the chance to be selected for a team, to win a championship, or to be awarded a college scholarship due to the physical advantage of male-bodied athletes. Title IX promises no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation or be denied the benefits of or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal funding assistance. This bill seeks to ensure we don't revert to discriminating against girls and women, as was the case pre-1970s. Now, for those of you who think this bill is about discriminating against those who identify as a gender different than their biological sex at birth, it is not, Mr. Chair. I want to put on the record that I love and value every person, including these individuals. They are precious and should have access to an even playing field as well, and they should have opportunities to participate in athletics. I am not transphobic, Mr. Chair, and I believe every person deserves an even playing field. This bill is not about blocking anyone from athletic opportunities. That would be in violation of Title IX. This is about ensuring Title IX is upheld. And thanks to Title IX, transgender athletes are protected from discrimination in sports and promised equal access to athletic programs. Their inclusion in sports absolutely must be protected, but it must not come at the cost of discrimination against women and girls. The goal of SB 40 to ensure discrimination against girls and women does not occur, that they are treated fairly and not at disadvantage in athletic programs compared to male-bodied athletes, whether they identify as male or female. undeniable evidence and scientific research conclude that the average biological male body is stronger, larger, and faster than the average female body, even after multiple years of testosterone suppression treatment. We see the imbalance, the male body advantages, particularly in high school athletics. For example, many male high school track and field athletes consistently beat the times of the best female Olympians who've trained intensely for years. Male-bodied athletes have a substantial advantage over female athletes in sports, regardless of the beliefs that the male-bodied athlete may hold about their sexuality or gender identity, and regardless of multiple years of testosterone suppression therapy. As many of you are aware, this topic has come to the forefront of public debate online and in the newsletter lately. Trans women are dominating in a variety of women's sports, both at the collegiate and high school level. To that end, I would like to read a section of a letter written by 16 UPenn swim team members regarding their teammate, Leah Thomas, a male-bodied athlete who identifies as a female. Quote, "We fully support Leah Thomas in her decision to affirm her gender identity and to transition from a man to a woman. Leah has every right to live her life authentically. However, we also recognize that when it comes to sports competition, that the biology of sex is a separate issue from someone's gender identity. Biologically, Leah holds an unfair advantage over competition in the women's category, as evidenced by her rankings that have bounced from 462nd as a male competitor to number one as a female competitor. Leah's inclusion with unfair biological advantage means that we have lost competitive opportunities. Some of us have lost records," end of quote from the letter. This is the concern addressed by this bill. Only 18 of the 40 members of the UPenn team will be chosen to compete at the Ivy League, at the Ivy Championships. If Leah Thomas is selected, a biological female will lose her opportunity to compete without an option for another category in which they could hope to qualify. Again, I emphasize that Leah Thomas and other trans athletes deserve the opportunity to compete and win fairly. However, it must not come at the cost of excluding otherwise qualifying biological females from the only category of sport in which they can hope to succeed. And I'd like to take a moment to point out one familiar to us in this imbalance of the male and female physiological makeup. Lydia Jacoby, who won the gold medal from Alaska, from Seward. Her time in the 100-meter gold in Tokyo was about seven and a half seconds longer than her counterpart who won the gold medal in the 100-meter, an American, Adam Peaty. There's just a vast difference. This issue at hand doesn't just impact college and world competitions, however. It can be traced all the way down to K-12 sports. Public school athletic programs are the primary opportunity for biological females to compete, win, and earn scholarships for their accomplishments. Not only are physiological advantages of male-bodied athletes a consideration when it comes to a level and fair and truly competitive playing field, but safety is another concern. When it comes to team sports and contact sports, the physical advantages such as strength, size, speed, of male-bodied athletes can put female-bodied athletes at risk of physical harm. SB 140 addresses the issue from several angles. First, the bill requires public schools and private schools competing against public schools to designate their teams as either male, female, or co-ed. Subsequently, the bill stipulates that membership on a team designated female must be based on the participant's biological sex. The bill also protects schools from the threat of legal action for upholding the proposed law. Finally, students are guaranteed the right to seek legal action if they are deprived of athletic opportunity or suffer retaliation or other adverse action due to a school's lack of compliance with the law. These protections would maintain competition and present Alaskan girls and women with an even playing field. For decades, Title IX laws ensured that biological sex-specific separations in athletics are legal. This has preserved competition while allowing women the chance to win. Senate Bill 140 is in line with Title IX. And in case you're wondering, the emergency order 13988 issued at the federal level about a year ago that tied funding to allow male-bodied athletes to participate in girls and women's sport was based on a court ruling pertaining to employment law, not to school sports law, and it is in direct violation of Title IX. I want to point out, too, that this bill stands for an act, emphasize that this SB 140 stands for an equal opportunity for all. The liability section of the bill would actually give a trans student athlete the ability to file suit if deprived of an athletic opportunity from a violation of this legislation. This bill is not designed to preclude trans individuals from participation in sports, but rather to ensure that participation in any category is fair based on the athletic's physiological ability. Enabling a disadvantaged group should not necessitate disadvantaging another group. The great triumph of Title IX and the success of millions of women and athletes must not be discarded in the name of social progress. And in closing, I want to make two final points. I want to read to you a quote from two athletes, female athletes. One was Olympic medalist Sharon Davis, and she was interviewed by BBC Sport. She said, "I have nothing against anyone who wishes to be transgender. However, I believe there's a fundamental difference between the binary sex you were born with and the gender you may identify as. To protect women's sports, those with a male sex advantage should not be able to compete in women's sport. It's not a transphobic thing. I really want to say we have no issue with people who are transgender. Every single woman athlete I've spoken to, and I've spoken to many, all of my friends in international sports understand and feel the same way as me." I'd also like to read a quote from a high school female athlete. Her name is Chelsea Mitchell, and she attends Canton High School in Connecticut, or she did. She may have graduated by now. Her quote in an article she wrote said, "I was bumped to third place in the 55-meter dash in 2019 behind two transgender runners. With every loss, it gets harder and harder to try again. That's a devastating experience. It tells me that I'm not good enough, that my body isn't good enough, and that no matter how hard I work, I am unlikely to succeed because I'm a woman." I read these quotes because I want to point out that the mental health of girls and women is at stake. We've heard the argument that mental health has been made on behalf of male body athletes who, via this bill, could still participate in co-ed or boys and men's sports, but not female sports. But we often fail to think about what happens if we don't address this issue when it comes to girls and women. We are impacting them, their mental health, if we allow male-bodied athletes to beat them out of spots on rosters, out of championships, and out of scholarships. So that's one point I want you to consider. And the final one is if that we do not address this, eventually, over time, girls and women's sports will be, frankly, totally eroded. Coaches are hired to take teams to victory. When one women's team has a male-bodied athlete giving that team an advantage, other coaches will be pressured to have the same advantage and will begin to recruit male-bodied athletes. Rosters will eventually fill up with more and more male-bodied athletes to increase this advantage and victories, robbing more and more females from athletic opportunities. We do not want this trend to take hold in Alaska, Mr. Chair. Your support to ensure discrimination against girls and women does not incur in our state is needed. Thank you. And at this time, we have a presentation. We're going to show part of it to you, and then we have some invited testimony, some athletes, some coaches, some expert testimony, and then we'll finish up the presentation regarding a few of the legal matters, and then we have some technical experts on that online as well. Okay. And with me is my trustee aide, Daniel Phelps, and as soon as you get the presentation going, he can put himself on the record. I'll be starting off with the presentation, then I'll be handing it over to Daniel.
On this current presentation?
Yes. So the first is a series of slides with input from Alaskans. And as soon as it shows up on the screen, there, it's showing up on the screen. So go ahead.
And, of course, Mr. Phelps, place yourself on the record.
This is Daniel Phelps, staff to Senator Hughes, for the record.
Thank you.
I'll quickly read these quotes. I'll read fast because I know visually you read faster in your mind than when someone reads verbally, so I'll go rather quickly. There will always be a significant number of boys and men who would beat the best girls and women in head-to-head competition. Claims to the contrary are simply a denial of science.
You might mention that was Martina Navratilova.
Yes. Thank you. And these are this is available on BASIS for anyone listening, so you can see these. And these are all quotes from athletes. I would have won my first ever high school track meet if it weren't for the male-bodied athlete. It was very disappointing. Margaret O'Neill, Hawaii. Those with a male sex advantage should not be able to compete in women's sports. Sharon Davies, British Olympic silver medalist. We're all about equality for women in sport, but right now that equality is being taken away from us. Unfortunately, there's nothing we can do because every time we voice it, we get told to be quiet. Tracy Lambregs, former women's Olympic weightlifter, New Zealand. NCAA Division II runner CeCe, formerly Craig Telfer of Franklin Pierce University, wins the 400-meter hurdles on May 25th, 2019. And you can see the difference just in the distance of the runners coming in second and third. Next quote. I don't know of a woman athlete who doesn't want trans girls to be treated fairly, but the cost of treating her fairly should not come at the cost of discriminating against a biologically female at birth woman. Donna Lopiano, former CEO, Women's Sports Foundation. Next quote. I didn't feel it was fair for this athlete to be playing and taking away a position from girls who could have started, which to me was so wrong in so many levels. Destiny Labanon, Maui, Hawaii. Next quote. We know who's going to win the race before it even began. It just seems like all our hard work is going down the drain. Alana Smith, Danbury, Connecticut. In 2017, men and boys around the world outperformed Allison Felix's best 400-meter more than 15,000 times. Next quote. I knew that I was the fastest girl here, one of the fastest in the state. Then the gun went off, and I lost. Chelsea Mitchell, Canton, Connecticut. Next quote. Coaches at the collegiate level are rewarded for winning, so these coaches will choose biological males in order to remain competitive in their conference. Where are the spaces for biological females then? What does this mean for equal opportunity for women? Cynthia Monteleone, Team USA Masters track athlete, coach, and metabolic practitioner. Next quote. When it comes to women's sports, biology matters. Inga Thompson, 10 times national champ, 3 times Olympian, 3 times world medalist, 2 times podium finisher in the Women's Tour de France. Next quote. When it comes to competitive athletes, sex segregation is the only way to achieve equality for girls and women. Martina Navratilova. There you go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Winner of 18 Grand Slam tennis single titles. And we're going to save this part for the end, and we're going to skip to some science and data that you need a brief at ease, Mr.
A brief at ease. Senate Education Committee is back on the record, and I believe, Daniel, I believe you're up, so once again, place yourself on the record.
Yeah. For the record, this is Daniel Phelps, staff to Senator Hughes, and as we consider this topic, we wanted to take into account some scientific research on this issue. In the bill packet provided to members, there were 2 scientific reports that have been peer-reviewed that study and address male-bodied athletes in women's sports. So the first one of those is a study done by the British Medicine Journal, and some doctors from the British Medicine Journal examined what the effects of gender-affirming hormone therapy on athletic performance among trans men and women. The research found that prior to hormone therapy, trans women held a 15 to 31% athletic advantage over biological females. And furthermore, after 1 year of testosterone suppression, which is recommended by World Athletics for inclusion in women's sports, trans women still had 9% faster mean run speeds than biological females. Another study done by Dr. Hilton and Lundberg reviewed the differences between biological males and females in athletics and assessed whether testosterone suppression removed the performance advantage of male-bodied athletes. They found that the performance gap between male and female-bodied athletes becomes significant at puberty. It's as much as 10 to 50% depending on the sport, and that strength, lean body mass, muscle size, and bone density are only trivially affected by testosterone suppression. We also wanted to point out some research that has been done with current data from the track and field events comparing male and female bodied athletes. Duke Law performed a study comparing top athletes in female track and field events to male athletes across a range of levels and found that female bodied athletes are not competitive for the win against males. Their findings can be viewed on this table, but if you look at the second column from the right, you see the best women's result across a range of events. And that's the top woman in the world, the most elite athlete. And the next column over shows boys, which would be male-bodied athletes under the age of 18. Those are their best times. In every category studied by this group, the times of 18-year-old boys beat the best women in the world. And that difference only grows more extreme if you look at men. And if you look all the way to the fourth column, you see the number of boys under 18 who consistently beat women, the best woman in the world, in the event specified, just in the year that this report was completed. And all the way to the right, you see a tally of instances of men outperforming female-bodied athletes across time. And you can see those numbers are in the thousands across every event in track and field.
And I'll just this is Shelley Hughes for the record, and I'll just add to that as far as the data. I want to mention that the tennis player, male tennis player who was ranked 203rd in the world, beat both Serena and Venus Williams. And we all remember Florence Griffin Joyner, nicknamed FloJo. She still holds the world record for 100 meter and 200 meter. Get this, a high school student has beat her time. So a high school student who would have pretty limited number of hours of training. And also a man who ranks 5,606th in as a male competitor has tied with her time. So that just shows the data and the differences between the body type. And if at this time, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to bring on our first set of invited testimony, I believe they are waiting online.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. It looks like the first one up would be Cynthia Monteleone. And if you'd care to state your name, any affiliation, and your location, and begin your invited testimony.
Aloha. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. Not sure how much time I have. I was just going to read my op-ed that I recently wrote, if that's okay.
Please proceed. Yes.
Thank you. I'm a mom, a coach, and a Team USA World Masters track athlete who is fighting for something greater than another gold medal. I'm standing for the protection of women's sports. If male-bodied athletes continue competing on female teams, it will be the end of women's sports. This is no exaggeration, and this is reality, and it's happening right now. At the 2018 World Masters Athletic Championships in Malaga, Spain, I competed in a 200-meter race against a male-bodied athlete, whom I beat by only a few tenths of a second. The next year, the same athlete beat my teammate in the hurdles for a place at the podium at the 2019 World Championship indoor meet in Poland. I just want to note that some people will argue that if I won, what's the big deal? However, it's greater than if you win or lose. I can also, just because one female beats one male doesn't mean that all the females can beat all of the elite males. And also this individual was about 6'5", so you can imagine the advantage over the hurdles when they switched events that next meet. So my teammate had trained harder than anyone I know. It wasn't just on the world stage that I experienced the demoralizing trend of male-bodied athletes displacing females from their own competitions. It was also on my home island of Maui. A year and a half after my experience in Spain, my daughter lost to a biological male identifying as female in her first ever high school track race. By the way, that's also been her only track race because that was the only one before COVID shut the seasons down. And here in Hawaii, we have not had track since. So she's in 11th grade and she's only ever had that one race and she lost it to a biological male. I had watched proudly as my strong and determined girl did all of the right things. She made personal difficult sacrifices to train her body to be as fast and fit as possible for her first race. Yet all of her hard work seemed to drift away along with the male-bodied athlete who had just transferred from the boys' volleyball team to the girls' team the season before. I'd like to also add here, it's not in my article, but that individual gave another girl a concussion during that volleyball season. So this athlete spiked the ball so powerfully, it injured a girl. So this is safety we're talking about as well. The athlete breezed right by her to win first place, leaving her to finish second. How can you win as a female when you're lined up to next to a male body whose strength, heart, and lung capacity and pace are all greater than your own, no matter what the treatment? It is not only the fact that my daughter placed second behind this individual in her first race, but we also began to witness all of the other ways this injustice impacts families like ours. The mental health impact on the girls who have to race male-bodied athletes, the personal lessons in effort rewarded and goals achieved, the future scholarships, awards, and accolades. Numerous studies have shown males continue to hold large physical advantages over females even when suppressing their testosterone. A male's muscular advantage is only minimally reduced when testosterone is suppressed, and males are still 12% faster than their female counterparts even after 2 years of feminizing hormones. We are not just hormones. What about the impact our cycle has on sports performance? What about the impact of birth control or pregnancy? These are all valid obstacles that males identifying as females do not have to address. The most important factor is the psychological toll. Many of the girls I coach suffer from anxiety over having to compete against male-bodied athletes. We all know the powerful scientific neurotransmitter connection between our minds and our bodies. When you think you can win, it's scientifically proven you have a better chance of doing it. Yet those of us who dare to speak out that competing against males is unfair are told, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It doesn't happen that often. Just keep your mouth shut and be quiet. That's what I was told when I raised questions as to the unfairness of running next to a male-bodied athlete at the World Masters meet. From coast to coast, we see college administrators, coaches, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, and many others in the media and culture trying to downplay our stories and sweep us under the rug. But know this, there is a groundswell. From my very own daughter raising her voice, along with the young track stars from Connecticut, to the female swimmers at the University of Pennsylvania who are stressed by the presence of a male in their locker room, not to mention the women who compete and often lose against this male-bodied athlete. Yet, indeed, there is a chorus of voices bravely recounting the missed opportunities, lost scholarships and titles, and the enormous challenge of competing in the sport you love on a playing field you know isn't level. How does this affect how girls think about the future? My daughter is a junior in high school and plans to follow in my footsteps and pursue a collegiate level track, but she is already worried about whether she will be able to compete for and receive scholarships. It is wrong for high school girls or any women at any age for that matter to worry about not being good enough simply because they are a woman. We are witnessing the nail in the coffin in the death of Title IX. Female athletes deserve their chance to receive accolades, awards, and scholarships. We must raise our voices on behalf of fairness and equal opportunity for all women before the entire category of women's sports is erased. Thank you. Mahalo.
All right. Thank you, Cynthia Monteleone. For the sake of time, we're going to move on to Allery Kidwell. Did I get that right? I was looking to see some nods, so it looks like I did, Allery.
I'm sorry. I just had to unmute my mic. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. If you state your name, any affiliation, and your location, and please proceed with your invited testimony.
Okay. My name is Allery Woods, actually, and I am not affiliated with anyone. I just speak for myself, and I'm in Lexington, Kentucky.
All right, and just please proceed.
Okay. So thank you for the honor of sharing my story and perspective with you today. Since I was 4 years old, I have known I was a female, and I grew up in the 70s and 80s in a very religious family. And this was during a time when I didn't even have a vocabulary to express what I felt, let alone tools to be able to transition. And about 9 months ago, I underwent full gender-affirming surgery, whereby I am both legally and clinically female. So we have come a long way since 1976 when I was 4, and I'm really, really grateful for that. I am a concerned trans woman who feels that something needs to be done to preserve fairness in women's sports, and I believe doing so will also help preserve the integrity of the trans community with respect to our relationships to all women. I believe there is a delicate balance that must be struck between the acceptance, support, and stability of trans women and the upholding of good faith, trust, and the confidence that our interactions are healthy and aim to support the mutual interests and goodwill that are essential for promoting long-term integration efforts based upon solid foundational principles. Principle number one in my book is that if trans women are women, then the struggles, the history, the suffrage, the setbacks, and the fears of all women are by extension ours as well. And I believe it is incumbent upon trans women to speak up for our fellow sisters, daughters, and mothers when our long and hard fought for rights and accomplishments are being systematically rolled back by the actions of those who identify with the same group and their supporters. Most distressing and tragic to me is hearing how girls' and women's voices are being silenced through coercion, all for an ideology that is, in its present form, untenable and unsustainable, not considering the voices and needs of our fellow females, in my opinion, is the antithesis of what it means to be a woman. It wasn't hormones or surgeries or a blue and pink flag or preferred pronouns next to my profile picture or makeup that made me a woman. What made me a woman was when my female friends and acquaintances said, "Welcome to womanhood, sister." And although I believe I've always been a woman, we do not exist in a vacuum, but in and with respect to one another. Those same women have stood by my side through thick and thin, and with their last breath will defend my rights, no matter our differences. And this is what really transformed me. Many of these same women have confided in me that it's not fair. They haven't asked me, but I know that if I could do something significant enough to help our cause, our struggles, and by our, I mean the collective, all women, it would mean so much because they know that they the dangers they face if they speak out. And I cannot tell you how much that breaks my heart. I was going to say a bunch of things, but I axed it out because you guys clarified a lot for me. So in conclusion, my primary purpose here is not only to stand with my sisters in their struggles and in support of them, but also, and by my sisters, I mean Cynthia and those who are suffering, but also to try to break through the barriers imposed by ideologues who wish to segregate us and tarnish the goodwill and trust we have with one another, and which we hopefully still wish to nurture and make better and stronger for the future. I believe we can do that through constructive dialogue and collaboration where no voice is silenced, even if you're opposed to trans women outright. I have found in the past, actually, that those who were most vociferously opposed to me as Allery, Through the cultivation of trust and kindheartedness, they have now become my most fierce allies. We need to hear you, and we need to release the fear from our relationships with one another, which has been imposed by these academicians, and all these people are trying to say that we can't speak our minds for fear of losing our jobs or whatever. And so I'm here in the hopes that after today we can expand our dialogue further to include trans and non-trans voices so that we can discover the best outcome for all. Thank you.
All right, Allie, thank you for sharing your story with us as well. Next up would be Tanner Hart, and I believe Tanner Hart is on the phone.
Yes, hello, my name is Tanner Hart. Currently I'm in Illinois.
All right, if you would please begin with your invited testimony.
Okay, thank you. As I said, my name is Tanner Hart. I competed in women's track and field in high school, and I won 13 Alaska State women's track and field titles. Was Gatorade Track Athlete of the Year my senior year in 2016, and then I later went on to compete in college at the Division I level as well. This bill is important because I, like many other women, have unfortunately had firsthand experience competing against a biologically born male who identified as a female. It is unfair and it's not right. Historically, we have separated both men and women's sports because we understand the indisputable fact that both men and women are genetically created different. For example, as we've spoken here before, men have greater lung capacity and physiologically larger hearts. Based on these two facts alone, it's reasonable to conclude that men and women should continue to be in separate categories because of how we're genetically made different. By allowing biologically born males to compete in women's sports, it forces women to be at a disadvantage, which is ultimately unfair to all biologically born women. And then I just lastly just want to thank you guys all for your time and consideration.
All right, Tanner, thank you for your invited testimony. And the last invited testimony on this line is Larry Whitmore. And Mr. Whitmore, I think I'm looking at you on the screen. And if you can hear me, please state your name, any affiliation, and your location, and begin your invited testimony.
Well, my name is Larry Whitmore, and I am right now out of Alaska on the Big Island in Hawaii. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Please begin your presentation.
My name is Larry Whitmore. I'm a former teacher and coach in the Anchorage School District, Anchorage, Alaska. I'm speaking in support of SB 140, Alaska Even Playing Field Act. I have spent many years coaching in the middle and high school in various sports, mainly cross-country running, swimming, basketball, and track and field for both boys and girls. I also work as an official for cross-country running and track and field. Our mission statement for track and field officials states, to regulate and administer interscholastic athletic competition in a fair and safe manner. This is being fair for everyone. This is not possible when biological males are allowed to compete with biological females. We already know that biological males have the greater bone density, bigger heart and lungs, and more muscle strength than biological females. As a father of two daughters, biological females, and teaching and coaching both boys and girls for many years, I know there are many other aspects that make competition between males and females unfair. When I refer to girls and women, I am talking about biological females. When I refer to boys and men, I am talking about biological males. When girls enter middle school around the age of 12 and 13, and then on to high school when they are 14 or 15, they begin to change physically as their bodies prepare for childbearing. As a teacher, coach, and father, I had to be aware of these changes each and every month. Many had difficulties, not only physically, but emotionally. Not all, but in several girls, this would affect their performance in the classroom and on the sports field. As these girls then entered high school, they began to develop physical changes more in preparation for childbearing. A number of girls that I coached in track and field had their best performances in their first 2 years of high school. They would come into their junior year and develop a little more in the hip area. For those girls in the running events, especially their hurdles, this was not good news, and for their performance level. The girls in the jumping events were also affected in a negative way. These changes are only due and true in the biological female, not in the biological male, which makes competition between men and women totally unfair. Just good old common sense says there is no way to justify the fairness of competing a biological male against a biological female. If we are to protect Title IX and save women's sports from being destroyed, we cannot, we must not allow the unfairness of biological males competing against biological females. I also strongly believe that everyone should be given the opportunity to participate and compete in interscholastic sports, including transgender persons, but on a fair and equal playing field. You might ask, how is this possible? One simple answer is this. We have a men's division for biological males, a women's division for biological females. We can have another division for transgender or co-ed. This would allow everyone to participate and compete in a fair and safe manner. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Larry Whitmore. So thanks to all the presenters so far, Cynthia Monteleone, Allery Woods, Tanner Hart, and Larry Whitmore. I believe next on the agenda is Daniel Phelps and the sectional analysis.
Yes. Yes. Again, this is Shelley Hughes, Senator for District F. Mr. Chair, before we go to the sectional analysis, because that becomes more technical and as far as the legal aspects, we did have a few slides I'd like Daniel to show you about this matter according to the courts, and then he'll go directly into the sectional analysis.
All right. Please proceed.
I just have, for the record, this is Daniel Phelps, staff to Senator Hughes, and I just have a couple slides showing some precedent established by the courts on this topic. There are many more cases that we aren't going to cover here, but here are just a few for your reference. In the United States versus Virginia, the court found that there are inherent differences between men and women, and these differences remain cause for celebration, but not for denigration of the members of either sex for artificial constraints on an individual's opportunity. In Quesick versus Rhode Island Interscholastic League Incorporated, because of innate physiological differences, boys and girls are not similarly situated as they enter athletic competition. In Kate B. Tennessee Secondary School Athletic Association, it takes little imagination to realize that were play and competition not separated by sex, the great bulk of the females would quickly be eliminated from participation and be denied any meaningful opportunity for athletic involvement. At this time, Mr. Chair, I'd like to proceed with the sectional analysis.
Please proceed.
SB 140, the Even Playing Field Act, has two sections. Section 1, page 1, lines 3 and 4, adds subsection D to AS 1418040, stating the word sex to mean biological sex. Section 2, which is page 1, lines 5 through 15, and page 2, lines 1 through 25, amends AS 14.18 by adding Article 2, designation of athletic teams and sports, and the following subsections. Subsection 1418150, page 1, line 7 through 4. A student or teams from a public or private school whose teams compete against a public school must designate each school-sponsored team or sport as follows. 1. Male, men, or boys, team or sport. 2. Female, women, or girls, team or sport. Or 3. Co-educational or mixed team or sport. And B. Any student who participates in an athletic team or sport that is designated female, women, or girls must be female based on the participant's biological sex. subsection 14.18.160, protects schools and school districts from complaints, investigations, or any adverse actions for complying with AS 14.18.150. Subsection 14.18.170 discusses liability and recourse for a student deprived of an athletic opportunity or suffers direct or indirect harm resulting from a violation of AS 14.18.150, or for a student who suffers retaliation for reporting a violation of the aforementioned. It also discusses same liability and recourse for schools or school districts that suffer direct or indirect harm as a result of a violation of AS 14.18.150 and allows for a 2-year statute of limitations. Subsection 14.18.180 defines school as an elementary, junior high, secondary, or post-secondary school, and defines school district as a borough, school district, city school district, regional education attendance area, state boarding school, and or state centralized correspondence study program.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Phelps. I do believe we have Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Shelley Hughes for the record. And I just, before you bring on our last three presenters, I just want to note that they're national experts on this matter. They understand Title IX and what's been happening across the country, and they're familiar with the technical legal aspects. So we saved them for the end. We thought they might be helpful if there are questions. So the first is a coach, an athlete, and an Idaho legislature, and the other two are attorneys with national organizations working on this issue.
All right, and so Larry Whitmore is on the schedule twice, correct? Nope, because I have, I'll confirm that when we, I see him still in the queue up here.
Representative Barbara Earhart, I believe, should be next.
Okay, well, yeah, I have Larry Whitmore's third, but we'll resolve that. And I'll, oh, there, don't read the paper, read the electronics. All right, so Representative Barbara Earhart, Idaho State Legislature, welcome to Senate Education, Alaska Senate Education Committee. Please place yourself in the record and state your location and begin your invited testimony.
Excellent, Mr. Chairman, good committee. Thank you very much for having me. I am Representative Barbara Earhart from the great state of Idaho. And I am pleased to be here. I'm particularly pleased that you're willing to take up this incredibly important issue, this issue that literally changed my life. I was 8 years old when Title IX was passed. And up until that point, people would ask me all the time, what is it you want to do and be when you grow up? I literally told them that I wanted to play sports. And you have to understand, because so many of you aren't of my age and era, that I was literally told that's not what girls do. And so when I say Title IX changed my life, it did, because I had the opportunity to actually play in junior high school and then go on to play Division I basketball on a scholarship. And that particular experience led me to be able to have a 15-year Division I women's basketball coaching career at four fantastic institutions, UC Santa Barbara, BYU, Washington State, and then as the head coach at Cal State Fullerton. And I believe that's why my testimony in so many of these states has been so interesting, not just the fact that I was the first legislator to sponsor this and bring this important matter forward in the state of Idaho, and it's been so gratifying to see so many states follow suit, but it's that background, that credibility, that actual experience. And so if I may, good committee, let me just start out by hitting something that I know that you're constantly hearing, and to me it's a complete false narrative, because the other side are, you know, they're trying to say that this is about the humanity and the community and the inclusivity. And though that is certainly a part of sports, no doubt, we have to understand that sports first begins with competition and then with winning. And I stress winning, because if it wasn't about the competition and the winning, then players wouldn't get cut. And trust me, coaches wouldn't get fired. So it is a key element to that which we're doing or trying to protect in Title IX and the sex-segregated opportunities that Title IX has provided. Let me just also share with you a firsthand opportunity that Idaho had in going through this. Idaho and our Idaho gals were forced to compete against someone by the name of June Eastwood. June Eastwood ran as John Eastwood for 3 years at the University of Montana, and then decided John's last year to run as June at the University of Montana, on the women's side. In 2020, before COVID hit and everything shut down, June ran in our indoor track Big Sky Championships, and June annihilated our women, absolutely, much like we're seeing Leah Thomas do. These are not just side stories that may happen. They are happening, and they will continue to happen. And the good legislator, Senator Hughes, had made the point, and it's a point that I've been making, and I believe it also shared with her, that in the world of NCAA collegiate athletics, and this is a truism, that we are an arena of peat and repeat. And when someone starts doing something, everybody else starts doing that, or they're left behind. And so I guarantee you that if June Eastwood and Leah Thomas had decided to compete as or try to identify as females their freshman year, in order for the rest of the coaches, say in the Big Sky Conference, to maintain and keep their jobs, every single coach would have been forced, and yes, still may be forced, to go out and find a biological male to be able to compete against June and against Leah, because if they didn't, they would lose their jobs by virtue of losing the meet or losing the game. That is a truism. You know, another thing that I'd kind of like to point out here as we go along, that it was interesting when I was coaching at UC Santa Barbara in 1995, Nike, who has at that time had been incredibly supportive of girls and women, had come out with an ad called If You Let Us Play. And what they documented were the benefits that girls received when they were allowed to participate in sports. And part of those benefits that Nike themselves had outlined are absolutely 100% indicative to girls. And that was, they would be something like 60% less likely to get pregnant. They'd be more likely to believe a man that beats them. And they'd be less likely to get breast cancer. These are all things indicative of women and why we must continue to protect these opportunities. Another thing that I sometimes like to point out is we have to understand that currently men have, biological males have the opportunity to compete. They get that opportunity. And our girls, females, get an opportunity. But what's happening now is our biological males are having the ability to choose to compete in either or, and that gives them two opportunities. And it's not that we just get one, it's that when they get two opportunities, they are taking away an opportunity from a female. We are literally going at times from two opportunities to no opportunities, and it simply is not fair. When we also consider that one of the narratives that is all about puberty, I can assure you as a collegiate coach and those people who continue to come to my sports camps and clinics, and even at times when I run tournaments, we will have tournaments that include tournaments for little kids, and we will have an all-kindergarten boys team. And then a division a little bit higher, we will have an all-kindergarten girls team, an all-second-grade girls team. And they simply are doing so poorly at competing with the boys that I will move an all-second-grade girls team to compete with the kindergartners. Now, let me say that again. Second-grade girls, move them down to compete with the little boys because they're getting annihilated by the second graders. And actually, they're getting annihilated by the little boys because that is who we inherently are. It's not a matter of puberty. It's a matter of who we are, who we came as with that XX and XY. That is inherently important to who we are as men and women, boys and girls. And that is, as has already been stated, it's okay. That should be celebrated. Good committee, as I tried to put the timer on here so I didn't go too long. I might be running out of time, but I'm sorry, maybe you'll have questions of me later in regards to the economic status that Idaho has experienced, even though we had entities saying that we would be hurt, how the NCAA is treating us, and some other things. So with that, I will conclude this testimony and wait for questions, but I thank you, again, seriously, thank you for taking this up. We are so appreciative.
Thank you, Representative. How do you pronounce your last name? Is it Ehart?
Yes, that's always interesting. It is Ehart with the long E and a lot of heart.
Thank you, Representative Ehart. I'm sure we'll see many of these invited testimonies back at a later date when we have more time. It looks like, thank you, Representative. Next up would be Matt Sharp. If you'd please place yourself on the record and also state your location and begin your invited testimony.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Matt Sharp, Senior Counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom in our Atlanta, Georgia office. Women deserve to compete on a level playing field. Allowing males to compete in women's sports destroys fair competition and women's athletic opportunities. Our law firm is proud to represent female athletes like Selena Soule in Connecticut, Madison Kenyon in Idaho, and several others in lawsuits seeking to preserve fairness in women's sports. Unfortunately, across the country, we're seeing more and more instances where women have lost championships or records and countless athletic opportunities. For example, in Connecticut, two males captured 15 women's championship titles, set 17 new records, and took over 80 opportunities to advance in competition that rightfully belonged to females. One of the individuals competed for several seasons in the male division, but then switched to the girls' categories and quickly dominated the events. That hurt girls like Chelsea Mitchell and Alana Smith, that you heard some quotes from earlier, that my firm is representing in a challenge to Connecticut's policy. I think we can all agree that every student deserves an opportunity to play sports. But the question is, what's the most fair way to organize them? And when it comes to sports, biology is what matters. And when we ignore the science and biological reality, it's women that pay the price. And the solution is SB 140, which ensures that all female athletes have that even level playing field to compete and win. SB 140, which simply sets an eligibility standard for female teams, would ensure that spots on teams at Alaska schools and colleges are not taken by male-bodied athletes, and that taxpayer-funded scholarships go to female athletes who spent years honing their talents to earn them. And that's why legislatures in several states, including Montana, South Dakota, Idaho, as we heard from Barbara Ehart, Florida, Arkansas, Mississippi, and as of just a couple of hours ago, Iowa, have now passed laws like SB 140 that protect fairness in both K-12 and collegiate sports. And I want to talk about the legal side of this. We've heard some of the quotes about how the SB 140 is consistent with the Constitution and federal law. And it's because federal courts have long recognized that it is constitutional to provide separate programs based on sex, and that includes sports teams, locker rooms, and even single-sex schools. For example, the Supreme Court in the Virginia Military Institute decision that you heard a quote from earlier was ruling that women must be permitted to enroll at VMI. And Justice Ginsburg, who authored the main opinion for the court, wrote that once women were admitted to VMI, female students would undoubtedly require separate physical standards, precisely because of the, quote, physiological differences between male and female individuals. And it's just for the same reason that men and women undoubtedly require separate physical competitions, in other words, athletics. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which has jurisdiction over Alaska, upheld a policy several years ago from Arizona that, like SB 140, merely said that males are not eligible to compete on female teams. The court concluded that it is, quote, a physiological fact that males would have an undue advantage competing against women, and that due to average physiological differences, males would displace females to a substantial extent if they were allowed to compete for positions on the women's team. The Ninth Circuit further recognized that redressing past discrimination against women in athletics and promoting equality of opportunities between the sexes was a legitimate and important government interest. And that's exactly the interest that SB 140 directly furthers. Based on these legally binding precedent and other similar court decisions that you heard referenced earlier, attorneys general from 14 states, including Alaska, filed a brief supporting the constitutionality of Idaho's women's sports legislation when it was acted in 2020. SB 140 has become more urgent than ever, especially for collegiate athletes, given the NCAA's recent actions. Rather than standing with female athletes by adopting a policy that ensures fairness, the NCAA punted to a patchwork of national and international organizations, some of which allow male-bodied athletes to compete on a women's team with no preconditions, and others of which have no policy at all. It's therefore urgent for this body to set a clear, fair, and scientifically based policy to guide schools and colleges throughout the state and to guarantee equal opportunities for our daughters and granddaughters to participate and win. And in closing, I want to emphasize the importance of being able to participate. Allowing males on girls' teams not only means that a girl is going to lose a spot, but she's also going to lose the numerous benefits that flow from participating in sports, like learning teamwork or how to overcome adversity and leadership skills. In fact, there was a recent survey that Inc.com did of women business leaders and CEOs, and they found that 94% of these leaders participated in sports. They described how vital those athletic experiences were to their professional development. Every girl in Alaska, many of whom will one day grow up to be business and community leaders, should have those same athletic opportunities available to her. Thank you, and I'm happy to stay on to answer any questions you have.
All right. Thank you, Matt Sharp. I don't know if we'll have time for questions. We're already pushing the 2 o'clock line on our committee meeting today, but I do anticipate we'll probably have some of you back at a later point if you're available. The last invited testimony today would be Jennifer Braceras. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. If you please state your name, your affiliation, and your location and begin your invited testimony.
Sure. My name is Jennifer Braceras. I'm director of Independent Women's Law Center, and I'm a former commissioner on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. I'm testifying today from the Boston area in Massachusetts.
All right. Please proceed.
Thank you. Competitive sport is a zero-sum game where some athletes make the cut and others do not. Someone wins and others lose. In a zero-sum competition, the inclusion of male-bodied athletes in women's sport inevitably means that females lose out. Almost 50 years ago, Title IX transformed sports by guaranteeing women the right to equal athletic opportunities. Congress enacted Title IX to end unjust discrimination in education and to expand educational opportunities for women and girls. Although the statute originally made no mention of athletics, in 1974, Congress passed an amendment proposed by Senator Jacob Javits of New York that directed the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to issue regulations regarding athletics. Those regulations state that schools may permit and educational institutions may operate single-sex athletic teams so long as they provide equal athletic opportunity for members of both sexes. Notice that the regulation says both sexes, meaning two. Title IX's binary conception of sex, under which schools may operate separate teams for male and female athletes, helped usher in a period of unprecedented athletic opportunity and achievement for women and girls, which you have already heard quite a bit about. That progress today is at risk. It is at risk from schools, athletic associations, and leagues that allow transgender athletes who were born male to participate in women's sports. But it is not simply about transgender participation in women's sports. One thing you have not heard about today is the way that male participation in women's sports is happening outside of the transgender context. Across the United States, there are many schools that operate field hockey or volleyball teams only for women and do not offer those teams for men. It's significant because many of these teams were initially created by schools in the 1970s in order to comply with Title IX. So they added field hockey and volleyball for women in order to increase the number of spots for female athletes. But sports like this are today at risk in states like Massachusetts and other areas across the country that require women's teams, such as field hockey and volleyball, to roster male players when the school does not offer a male team in that particular sport. Last fall, Independent Women's Forum and Independent Women's Law Center issued a report called Competition, Title IX, Male-Bodied Athletes, and the Threat to Women's Sports. And in that report, we talk about this phenomenon. There's actually a photo in the report of a female field hockey player, who happens to be my daughter, playing against male field hockey players in high school. My daughter is now a Division I field hockey player. She's now in college. But even a person of her athletic ability who plays at a Division I level had trouble going up against high school male athletes, boys who play hockey, boys who play lacrosse, and just thought, oh, well, why don't I take on a fall sport and go out for the girls, you know, go out for field hockey. There was not just one team that her high school team had to play against that had males. There were at least three teams that had multiple male field hockey players on that team. Defenders of policies like these say that they are necessary to promote fairness and inclusion. But what these policies actually do is treat female athletes unfairly and deny them equal opportunity to compete. So not only did my daughter have to go up against male field hockey players, but there were female field hockey players at those other schools that didn't make varsity because a boy did. As you've heard today, the average male is bigger, stronger, and faster than the average female. Because of this scientific fact, when male-bodied athletes compete against women, women most often lose. But Title IX not only protects our right to fair competition, it protects our right to play at all. Allowing biological men to compete as athletes on women's teams with limited rosters means that there are fewer spots on those teams for females. So women get relegated to the JV team or don't make the team at all. Perhaps if they do make the team, they get less playing time when a man takes the field, or they may receive less scholarship money. The fight to protect women's sports is not simply about transgender politics. It's about fairness and equal opportunity for women to play competitive sport. And if the federal government isn't going to protect Title IX and stop discrimination against female athletes, then the states must step up and prohibit the participation of all male-bodied athletes in women's athletic competitions. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jennifer Braceras, for offering your invited testimony. Sadly, at this point, we're out of time for the day with this Thursday edition of the Senate Education Committee. Senator Hughes, do you have a minute? I think the next crew's in here. We're probably going to lose the space in like 9 minutes. But do you have any closing comments?
I just want to thank the committee for hearing the bill and for you scheduling, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank the testifiers. I think they did an excellent job of presenting the dilemma that we face and the solution. So thank you very much.
All right. And thanks to Mary Gwen and Emma for humoring us for the extra half hour today. And at this time, with no other business before the committee, Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been patient and I've listened to a lot of the discussion from the offered experts, and I hope that I have an opportunity to ask questions about this bill. I wanted to just, for the record, say three things. The first is that the cases that were provided earlier by your staff are from 1977, 1992, and 1996. Recent case law is actually controverts that. The Idaho bill that we've heard about was enjoined by the Ninth Circuit. That's currently in 2020. That's currently before the Ninth Circuit for review and full panel. In West Virginia, in BPJ versus West Virginia, the case was struck down. Boystock v. Clayton is another recent case that's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, which interpreted Title IX as it's been interpreted by the current administration as protecting transgender rights. So I just want to be sure that we understand that there is a different side to this argument. Our own Department of Legislative Legal Services has provided a legal memorandum, which I'll provide to the committee, which underscores the unconstitutionality of this particular piece of legislation. And it'll be my intent to put that on the record and to have a more deep discussion about that. And finally, the last point is that as a member of the Suicide Prevention Council, as are Senator Stevens and has been Senator Michicki, I want you to know that there is direct data connecting this kind of legislation to increased levels of suicide among transgender youth. I'll be bringing that up as well because safety was brought up as an issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Begich. Not meaning to disquiet any other voices on this. Honestly, we do anticipate spending a significant amount of Education Committee time to this topic. Senator Hughes?
Mr. Chair, will there be an opportunity to address and discuss what Senator Begich brought up with our expert testifiers? I'm just requesting that we make time for that in a future hearing.
And I do believe it'll all depend on, you know, the limited time we have in the schedule and the availability of invited testimony. But the plan would be to bring them back as they're available.
Thank you.
All right. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Monday, March 7th at 9 a.m., and we will be adjourned at 11:57 a.m.